It's July 25th, 1977. We're here in Bothell, is it? Bothell, Washington. And we're talking to Walter Robertson. Walter, when were you born? Oh, tough question comes first.
7/19. Very sure.
And what were your parents' occupation?
My father was...
Have any inkling or influence as you were going through all these growing up phase that you were going to go overseas at any time? Thank you very much.
Well, I'd already been overseas. Mm-hmm. I'd been in World War II.
Mm-hmm. Were the ambulance driver was just an assignment, or was it by religious preference, or?
No, it was very good because yeah. It's the only vehicle that has heat in it in the wintertime.
Ah, and the winter in France and Germany in 1944-45 was cold.
It was very cold.
Very cold.
That's why I went over there, because I was in an Army specialized training program.
Did that pre-med interest when you left the Army?
No, I graduated, some of the science I was interested in, chemistry, I graduated with a degree and went to work in market research for Cincinnati Chemical. I sent for types of jobs they had and as well as teachers needed, and I used to think I'd like to be a teacher.
You went to school, you got a degree in chemistry. You graduated, you got a job teaching working in Cincinnati. Went out to the reservation as a vacation? Just on a vacation, and you found the reservation interesting?
I found it rather interesting.
That's very interesting.
I major in chemistry, but I find change in it. And we had to write a thesis, senior thesis. Mm-hmm. And I didn't see anything I liked except the last one. The economics of primitive peoples.
and then you went and visited
and
something.
And maybe that was something that kind of stuck to me.
Although we know that the now primitive people I can think of. So you got a job, you actually went back to school. Did you keep your job, your day job, so to speak? What, you just quit your job and went back full time and got your teaching credential?
Well, I found that they have a program. I tried to go back into the University of Cincinnati.
Mm-hmm.
Until you have had experience with children,
mm-hmm.
and I know whenever they flunked out of liberal arts, they come right into the, teacher's college.
Uh-huh.
So I had a friend and then told me about Harvard had a program for liberal arts graduates. So they accepted me. Cincinnati wouldn't.
At Harvard.
They were able to accept.
I'll have to tell that story to a friend of mine who works at the University of Cincinnati. Your standards may be a mite high. No? No, they're just right. And you went out to the Navajo Reservation.
Directly
how long were you
out there?
There,
yeah.
How long were you there?
Well, it was about 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought they were getting a little, or at least down the line would be more modern.
Mm-hmm.
So I was looking for an overseas job.
Trying to go to some area where your skills would be needed most?
For the start over.
Mm-hmm.
I know I was influenced by a lady who taught out there in the most remote location, very beautiful canyons and all.
Remember her name?
Elizabeth Eubank.
Uh-huh.
And I thought I would like to, she was well known around that.
Uh-huh.
I thought I'd like to be like her, start over, start like she did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I did in Vietnam.
Yeah, you sure did. How did you hear about IBS?
Oh, a couple different places, I think.
Volunteer service and other peace churches were all involved on the IBS board. Did you have any, was there any religious connection between yourself and the IBS? What's your religious background?
Well, it was Protestant, mm-hmm. but I'm in the pro.
That's part of your starting over thing. I think you're very consistent. That's
well,
a very,
I think
a very nice life.
I think it was a product of seeing what happened to the people that I had to work with and how man destroyed every culture he's come into contact with.
Well, at least he's done it to his own.
He has
yes,
done
that's
it
good.
To his own.
It's, It's a very fair-minded, culturally destructive society, if you want to call it that.
I don't know. It's sort of a stretch, but then I read that they learned down there 2,000 years ago they were doing to the Jews, the Christians were doing to the Jews what they did to the Indians 1,500 years later. I don't think there's very much progress there.
No, so and it's actually quite sad.
And I felt, well, I go to a hospital sometime, I don't want to put down Protestant. And so, and I think also living on the reservation, I felt very close to God because creation is so beautiful there.
Yeah.
It always has been. So I had those two conflicts every day. The beauty of the creation, and the closeness of the Navajo to the creation, to God. Kids. And it's better than nothing there. And because you can sense some of it through the Navajo and how true it came. Because that's our relation to people. Our relation to Navajo. And the same as our relation to Vietnam. I wanted to see Hue. I had not seen Hue. And I had some few days in there, but of course didn't come through to teach at a little island in the Pacific. And I thought to myself, Hue is a place they like to destroy. Because it's so cultural. They wanted to do that in Kyoto in Japan.
But they didn't.
Because of one guy, Raisha, and he happened to be married to a Japanese. And I found that on an hour reservation. I'd be talking to somebody. Usually a minute, I know they don't care. Then if it goes on, I wonder about this guy. Very often they're married. I think it's a very close bond there, very to be sensitive in a sense. So
Robert McNamara in his book tried to say that while there weren't any advisors who could have told him about Vietnam, and a lot of people upset because there certainly were, but they weren't the kind of people he would recognize.
I care to read any books about Vietnam. I think I may have read.
When you were, you heard about the IVS from a variety of different sources. When did you decide to apply?
Well, actually, I think home I was going to stay at my parents' house and find my teaching job in order to do that. But on vacation, summer vacation, I was on top of one of these big mesas looking over the Colorado River, very isolated place. And my horse got spooked when I dropped a, I don't know anything about riding horses. And there was a, and I broke my arm. And the Indian guide there, he was scared to death. But I was calling. Gone down and he went to the trading post and they radioed in. And they were just building the Glen Powell Dam. So there was happened to be a helicopter there, and just before dark, it came up, and a few minutes, I was down in the hospital. Never been in a hospital before. So that delayed my plans to go right away, so I decided, well, I'll come back. And I did came back to teach another year on the reservation and then application. I just filled out the forms and such.
They sent you a ticket?
Sent me the ticket.
Did you go from San Francisco?
Albuquerque.
To Albuquerque.
Because I was in New Mexico at the time.
Did you go all by yourself?
Yeah. To Washington, D.C.
To Washington, D.C.
And they had the orientation.
You had an orientation. What did you think of the orientation?
Oh, it was fine. We went to a camp there. I suppose looking back, if I was to learn the language, I suppose, like the Peace Corps, I would wanted to learn it more thoroughly, but I don't pick it up very easily, but it was all right to jump right into it and get the feeling place.
What was your assignment going to be?
Well, I guess in education, because that's what I was, and then I was lucky. A lot of guys wanted to go up in the highlands. It's cool in there. But because I'd worked with the Navajo, I Don Luce thought I could work with the tribal people. That's what was my ambition was to go into it.
Where was that?
Up in Khantoum.
In Khantoum. And what group were you with? Mountain Yards? You were with?
The very Mountain Yards were around there, and it was a Vietnamese town.
But it was a Vietnamese town.
Colonial town, mm-hmm. But it had mountains further back, and they had a village, a typical village, right up to the border of the town. Mm-hmm. I thought that was kind of, and it was just like the town I grew up in Perrysburg, Ohio. It was set out the same way, the trees and sidewalk and the frame houses. I felt thoroughly at home.
So did you work?
I contacted the people wanted me to. They had a lot of desks in this room, and they kept moving all these desks around, trying to get my desk in a place. Finally got there, and I knew I would never use it, and I never did go back. I think you learn in education that at your level, I never was interested in any administration. Mm-hmm. And administration is kind of so far away from schools that I didn't care for that end of it at all. I thought I was a people-to-people program is what IBS was.
Right.
I took advantage of it. I figured only $80 a month, I can do that.
So what did you do?
Well, I used to go, I had a Mountain Yard interpreter. We used to go out to the villages, Mountain Yard village, and visit.
Do you remember the group? Were they Rade or...?
That sounds familiar. It begins with a B.
Okay.
I can't remember. There were several groups, and I don't know mm-hmm. how many, 10 or 20 dialects just in that one province. Mm-hmm. But I liked the most peaceful thoughts was walking in those villages because everything was natural. Mm-hmm. And there weren't a lot of people around. They were probably in the field somewhere. But I felt in heaven there. But I knew, wait, this is based on colonialism, and that's not what's, for me actually having to be able to even be there. Mm-hmm. And I knew, that's kind of a sandy basis. I didn't have all those great hopes, but mm-hmm. I thought if I could stay there, mm-hmm. I would visit China, Russia, and India, mm-hmm. very close places. Mm-hmm.
What did you do in the villages? Did you work with Mountain Yard teachers, or did you
well,
set up
I
a
met
of your own?
I would talk to the teachers. Mm-hmm. But there again, there wasn't anything I could do much. We didn't have any supplies. Mm-hmm. They had a very small, small place about, not even big enough to park a car in, and that was all the USAM supplies for the whole province. Mm-hmm. There was one USAM, is now USAID, one USAM person there. Nothing, this is a Navajo reservation. They don't have anything either, so I didn't, just what they would ask me for was things like sheet metal for their school. Mm-hmm. And I went out, and I also was down in Pleiku. Later, went down there. Decided not to visit any more villages because they go out there and they want something. Mm-hmm. And I don't have it. Mm-hmm. We did get something, I'd give them. But one time they sent some village tool kits. They had a pipe wrench in there about this long.
A four-foot-long pipe wrench.
For bamboo,
village.
I guess.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Very important.
It was so heavy.
Yes, all the steam engines that they have in these villages really require the tools. Yeah. Were you ever able to get things like sheet metal for the school roof?
They had some, but the USAM guy would order them, but then you had to race down in your jeep to the airfield mm-hmm. to get there first before the province chief got it. Mm-hmm. He'd stick them in his basement or somewhere. Mm-hmm. That was one of the earliest clues that the way things operated over there.
Relationship generally, though, with the USAID people?
I think so. We were all in the same building. I felt I learned a lot there because everything was in the same building. The Vietnamese Army, U.S. Army representatives, IVS, USAM. So just to bustle around there, you get an idea that things were not progressing very well. They put up a chart, so many wells dug, and it'd be there year after year, the same number. They never changed. Of course, those were all my gripes when I was on the Navajo reservation.
Did you live?
Well, I rented, I knew it was starting new there, and I rented a house. It was just being put up, and there were three sections, and I rented the two. They were all ready. It was right across the way from the Army compound. There were these two empty ones. I wanted the whole thing. But at the end of it, there was this one occupied by the girls that right across from the Army compound. They were very nice.
Yes, they were. Huh?
And I had taken in my son. Everybody else had a houseboy, and I knew him from Shining Shoes. He used to come in shine our shoes when we eat at the restaurant. And one of the IVS guys told me they have no home at all. I couldn't believe that. He looked good, I guess, because he won the lottery and he had a white shirt on and everything. Anyway, we had built this, and I invited him to come over if he wanted to be the houseboy. I couldn't see how they could live outside it. In Ohio, those winters are pretty bad. But he did. He came over, and I can see that a lot of the other places have these big strapping Americans, has some little Vietnamese guy washing all their clothes and everything. I couldn't see that. I spoiled him. Even the lady head of the education that came out, you know, and she didn't think that I should give him money for play pool or I should keep him busy. I should do this. I should do that. But I learned a lot of things on a reservation. You learn from kids, you know. I learned a lot from him, and I said, he's been working hard for several years. He deserves a vacation.
And you later adopted him?
I later adopted him.
And did you...
There was one. I never saw him very much. He was in the agriculture park. And, I think it was just... We just left it. He helped me in one respect. That I had been down in Pleiku or the Visiting Village or somewhere around. And we came back with an interpreter the next morning. And the Army compound had been fired on. A couple of Viet Cong had come in, snuck under the fence. They had satchel charges. An American soldier, captain, happened to be there at the right time in the right place, and he shot one, and the other went under this fence, and he shot and hit his satchel bag, and there were little pieces of him all over the fence. That morning, I said, there's going to be a war sooner or later. I want to be sure I see just how it will happen. And the thing about it was, Khantoum was so secure. I saw the grass over there where that was, and I said, I ought to tell them to, cut that grass. Somebody can creep through the grass. And that's what they did, right up to the fence there. I felt so secure. And then I began thinking, well, why did this happen over and over? There had to be a way. And finally, after 2 weeks, and I think I figured out, well, my son, everything had closed down during Tet. They're opened from up to 10 o'clock at night every day of the year, and then Tet comes, and then they all close down. And I'd had nothing to eat, but my son knew the people in the restaurant, took me down there, and they went and took me in the back kitchen. And what I said, there's something going on here that never attacked this town, even to the point where I didn't bother to tell them to cut their weeds.
Mm-hmm.
So I finally dawned on me that it was Tet, had something to do with Tet.
Mm-hmm.
So even if it was only some excitement about it, I don't know. But the Chinese said 100 men would have been killed, and maybe they would have been if they caught them.
Mm-hmm.
So I went down to play coup after that, in that province, and right away I said, they're going to attack, play coup over Tet.
Mm-hmm.
That was back in July. And I said, well, I ought to tell them, and I said, well, I'll wait a while because there's so many spies around, loose lips and everything, and I'll wait. Which I should have done, I know, but because eventually, just before Tet, I was up at the visiting a village, and we were looking down on the Pleiku campground. There's both Vietnamese and Americans are looking down on it. And this is a beautiful place to attack from there. And all the people crowded around me, and all they wanted were a few sheets of aluminum roofing, that's all. Their thatched roof was leaking.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't want anything else.
But all the roofs down there are aluminum roofs.
No, yeah. Thatched roofing, but they knew that we had it. And
no, I meant like the military compound in Kontum, the hospital. There's a hospital down there, too.
It's the Army camp.
Yeah, the Army camp. Yeah.
No, it was buildings and modern in a way.
And I was just thinking of all the sheet metal down there.
Oh. Yeah.
Yeah.
But they couldn't afford it.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I'm not going to visit again. I don't want the USA to feel it embarrassed in a sense that we can't provide.
Mm-hmm.
I would rather not raise their hopes.
Mm-hmm.
I said, then I'm not going to visit any more villages because they expect something,
mm-hmm.
and what else could you do? You know, some basically they have needs, it's just like the Navajo.
Mm-hmm.
So, one of the team guys visited me right after that,
mm-hmm.
and I said I'd like to leave. And I left and went down to the Delta,
mm-hmm.
and taught school. It was very enjoyable, teaching English all classes from elementary all through high school.
Mm.
A lot of different teachings. The teacher was right there.
Mm-hmm.
She wanted something to say, such and such. Anyway, I guess it was about February, I looked in that Pacific Army newspaper.
Stars and Stripes.
Pacific Stars and Stripes.
Pacific Stars and Stripes.
And that play coup attack.
Uh-huh.
At that time, and I said, I knew it would happen. And to me, I was shocked. It just, you're coming from that world down to another world,
mm-hmm.
and it completely slipped my mind. The thing it was, they began bombing after that. And they stayed into that mode, I think. And even McNamara said in his book that it played a great deal in regard to a few sheets of aluminum. And I read an article in Foreign Affairs after the 10th anniversary. Said if they'd only waited about 6 months when they learned that there was a revolution against the communists in Indonesia, there was no purpose of it, of going in there and escalating.
Because the Indonesians put down their own.
Yes, but Kissinger said they have to do it, a great power lives up to its commitments. I thought if they might have held off for another six months, because those people are funny, they tried to destroy a bridge in Kontum. They didn't come back for two, they never came back. You know, it had been 2 years since. But Americans, they come back the next night or something. They want to destroy a bridge. But the Vietnamese, you know, I don't know. It's a contradiction, everything.
Hmm.
So
now that's an interesting, the other is an interesting observation, because did you work in the Delta? What province?
It was at Meetah.
Meetah.
It was a public school.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed it very much. I know the teacher I really liked. And when I was leaving, it was the last day I came to say goodbye or whatever. And I was told, I'm going with to the United States. And my son says, oh, I want to go to the United States. I kicked myself now for not inviting her, because I think I loved her a lot and I didn't. But I was caught off guard. I had to go the next day.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. And the difference.
How did you arrange the adoption of your son?
Well, I went to the embassy. And they had a list of lawyers recommended. And
mm-hmm.
they said, this guy seems to be pretty good working out.
Mm-hmm.
It was a long process. I think we had to go up to the premier or something, this huge office in this French colonial building.
Mm-hmm.
They had to go very top,
mm-hmm.
which, just like in the province, I want to make a small bulletin board. They said, you'll have to see the province chief for that. Well, this they had to see them. It worked out.
Mm-hmm. Did he go with you to Meetah?
My son?
Yes, uh-huh.
No, while I was in Khantoum, his teacher was drafted in the army.
Mm-hmm.
He hadn't been to school, and he's the one who wanted to go back to school.
Mm-hmm.
And he did, but then when he couldn't do that, he wanted to go to Saigon. And the principal of the Mountain Yard dormitory there was going down there, so he went with him and
mm-hmm.
went to school down there. Meetah. He came down there, I think sometime, and took me over there, which at night where they had these clams cooking.
Mm-hmm.
He did those little things, go in Khantoum, take me to Kailua, and that sort of thing.
Uh-huh. Did you finalize the adoption while you were in Meetah?
No. Well, about the same time, yeah. And it took several months.
Mm-hmm.
And the only reason I wanted to do it was just sort of some extra protection for him. I had no idea of our future at the time.
Mm-hmm.
He hadn't escalated or done anything like that. But I just thought, you know, the U.S. does have a powerful arm there, and
mm-hmm.
he might as well be under.
No.
And
so you weren't thinking of, I'll rescue him from this war and take
no,
him back to the States?
No.
And you were just trying to give him a little bit of legal protection.
Yes.
Or, yes. Uh-huh.
And as it happened, I was lucky I did this, because when they escalated and I realized, you know, that when all the people coming in, the Americans, that there would be, the university would really be under a lot of pressure from people wanting to come in to learn English. And of course, it had so many needs anyway, I would figure. And I thought, if he wants to get an education, I'll have to take him to the United States.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to stay there. I wanted him to be there. But I thought it was now or never. The fact that he was adopted, he was able to go with me
mm-hmm.
to the United States, but to a little Pacific island that I... We went 400 miles south of Guam. It's called Yap.
Oh, yeah.
You heard of Yap. The one with the big wheel of stone money.
Uh-huh.
With a hole in the middle that they would bring by their boats. The farther they went, the harder the journey, the more it was worth. And they had this, you know, stacked against one right next to the other. In a village and all covered with green moss. It was kind of picturesque. And
mm-hmm.
it was one of those things that had my thesis that I had written about.
Mm-hmm.
It was the least developed of the... It was a U.S. trust territory, mm-hmm. the Pacific mm-hmm. Islands. And the least developed. Changed a lot since.
And well, renewal of your horizon while you continued with your carrying the skills. Did you teach in yet?
That's what I did. I taught there. And it was very fortunate for my son Yai because they had American teachers there. They had one class of 10 students made up of about 5 American students and 5 of the faster Yapi students. Mm-hmm. And he fitted right in there. He went from a 5, went from the fifth, in 2 years he went from 5th grade all the way up through junior high, mm-hmm. which he might not have been able to do any other. Mm-hmm. He probably would have done all right if he'd come directly to the U.S., but mm-hmm. he couldn't have come directly to the U.S. I never planned any of this. It just worked
out. It just worked out.
So he graduated in 1975 uh-huh. from University of Arizona in agronomy. Uh-huh. And 75 is when Saigon fell uh-huh. right at the same time.
What did you think of that?
Well, when I was in Saigon, I was invited to a party of one of the American workers for USAM. And went up on top of there. It was a high rise. And I looked over at the jungle, and I remember that's where that was Cambodia, a very short way over there. So I thought what they will do is they will come from the jungle, the people will panic, and the soldiers never believed in their cause will follow the people, and that will be the end of Saigon. That was when we left 67, I think. Mm-hmm. And that's the way it essentially ended. The people panic. So they're tired of war. That's all they've known but war. Yeah, I thought it was a big fun thing, and send everybody home. If they'd kept the soldiers there 4 or 5 years like they did in World War II, they'd never put up for that kind of a war. But by rotating them out of there, even though they lost a lot of skills, they didn't have too good a protest group, I would think.
I mean amongst the soldiers.
Yeah, whereas the Vietnamese were in there decades, maybe.
Yes, for the duration.
They were, that's about July in 1963.
July of 63.
Right.
So you would have been there another 2 years.
Another 2 years in Yap.
Oh, you did 2 years in Yap with IVS?
No.
Oh, no.
With the U.S. Trust Territory.
U.S. Trust Territory.
It was under the U.S., but it was their own government, okay. In a sense.
So you were only in Vietnam from 63 to 65.
Right.
And, July of 65, you know, that's when the decision was made to commit a massive number of U.S. troops.
65, yeah, 65, that's when I felt that we'd have to get. If they had not done that, I would have stuck around so long. When they come in, people with influence will be able to get into the universities and get classes.
No, I just to make that clear, beginning about March of 65, mm-hmm. there was a steady buildup.
Yeah.
That finally escalated massively after July. Yeah. Did you go from Yap?
Well, we came to California, and the education head of the education, that lady, knew someone in California. Mm-hmm. They were friends, I guess. And through that person in California, I got a job on the Hooper Reservation, mm-hmm. and north of the northern part of California. Mm-hmm. And we were there just 1 year, and decided to come on back to the Navajo Reservation. Mm. Not familiar with that.
How long were you there?
You reached the rock.
And the Navajo Reservation for the next 20 years.
20 years. So you retired as a teacher on the Navajo Reservation? Did you retire as a teacher?
After, in 1988.
In
1988.
How did you come here?
Well, I retired because I was very tired. I don't know if I have chronic fatigue syndrome. Mm-hmm. Or I don't know.
Well, there's a lot of, in the desert up there, there's a lot of fungus up there that can wreak havoc with your immune system.
It's still with me, and my son had owned a trailer, he still does,
mm-hmm.
down in near Phoenix in mm-hmm. a little town of Wickenburg.
Mm-hmm.
Nice
little town.
Yeah, very nice.
Yeah.
So I went down there to retire, and finally they wanted me to come up here, stay up here, and mm-hmm. decide it would be better
mm-hmm.
if I wasn't getting anywhere down there. But so I've been living here by at least.
Well, it's a nice, I mean, it's as soon as I turned down 35th, I realized it was a really pretty place.
Where was it?
No, just coming down the highway here.
Oh.
I mean, it's all getting built up between here and Highway 5, but coming down here, suddenly you're in the trees, and there's a different feeling altogether.
Well, that's what I liked, was
mm-hmm.
when we went back to Arizona, we passed through the ponderosa trees, mm-hmm. and it's, you know, he said, you didn't tell me it was like this.
It was a little bit like the highlands of Vietnam.
And then when I went to Monument Valley, I took him out there, and he said, why didn't you tell me about this? But that was home to me.
Uh-huh.
But he said, he went to school at Tuba City.
Mm-hmm. I've been there.
And have you been there? Seems like everywhere I've been, you've been.
It seems like following you around.
So he went there, and he said, what are you going to put me in with white people?
This being a lifelong racist plot. Yes, that's funny.
I'm thinking of something new.
Right.
So he had made some friends in the summer. Their idea is to take care of the parent, not the other way around.
That's right.
So he got a job down at a golf course in Flagstaff, Arizona.
I was just there this March.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very nice place. And met a couple of students of the high school whose parents were teachers. And they invited him to stay there
mm-hmm.
and go to Flagstaff High School,
mm-hmm.
for which in the last 2 years it was a good chance for him to live with the family and get to know the people better.
White people.
And get to know white people.
Yes.
And he picked up idioms and things. So, you know, there wasn't much on the reservation for him to be there.
No, not for high school. That was a very fortunate
But he... in all 4 years, he wrestled,
mm-hmm.
and he did very well in wrestling. The problem was that he was small. He couldn't lose weight. The lowest weight, mm-hmm. 106, was his natural weight.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas some of these big guys, 120, they can drop down
mm-hmm.
and make it more. But he still went to state, and he did pretty good.
Did he get a scholarship?
Yes, he got a scholarship
wrestling
to go.
Or academic?
No, just got a scholarship in it. He did very well. He was elected the National Honor Society.
Mm-hmm.
I was amazed.
Why were you amazed? He's your son.
Well, I know, but because I've taught on the Navajo Reservation, and it was so difficult
mm-hmm.
for another. But he at least had about 5 years of education in his own language.
Mm-hmm.
And where he's come from, being a shoeshine boy. And then,
mm-hmm. What does he do now?
He got interested in the golf course work. He worked there for a couple of summers. So he majored in agronomy and minored in golf course
maintenance.
And thinking, should he go into this? What he had hoped for was to be able to go back to Vietnam and help the country
mm-hmm.
and study agronomy.
Right.
He was very good in math and things. Uh-huh. They would have been done very well in computer, but
mm-hmm.
He grew up in a village,
mm-hmm.
a I think that's very strong. He was a leader of a gang of about 14 kids. He was ready to fight. You know, he was small, but he was a leader because he was, wasn't afraid of anything. He's not afraid of anything.
Did you ever contribute to IVS, you know, send contributions to IVS after you left?
Well, I get their mail.
Uh-huh.
And I occasionally send in something to them. I went with them, I guess it was 1988, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
When I retired, Don was taking a trip over to Vietnam.
Uh-huh, yeah.
So I went with him on that trip.
Uh-huh.
Really had a lot of feelings. Well, it was a haunting feelings to me. It was a post-war era. And towards the evening time, you'd have these bicycles, very few cars at that time,
mm-hmm.
these bicycles coming down so quietly, the streets,
mm-hmm.
several abreast. And to me, like it was a ghost, you know, like a war, a ghostly war.
Mm-hmm.
These people passing, it was on my head had passed that way.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it wasn't kept up at all. It needed paint everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go down to Saigon, and this one guy who'd been a principal at that Montagnard dormitory in Kontum,
mm-hmm.
I corresponded with him, and he met me there, and got on this cyclo, and all this busy traffic, you know, just so different from Hanoi, you can reach out and touch people, and that's a kind of, I still remember the, how close you can get to people that out
in touch. Yes, in Hanoi you can. Yeah.
But in Hanoi is this haunting.
Mm-hmm.
And to see these old buses, so old, they were like carcasses themselves that had been left there.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of the smell of death if you want to think about it. I've never, I, the white man is, it always is something to be fought against. That what I wanted to fight against it. I wanted to outline my views just before they began escalation.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, writing letters too long, you'll have to shorten them up.
Uh-huh.
I never did write it.
You never did.
But I was...
You're going to write for, like, in an IVS newsletter?
Well, you send these letters out to people.
Right, exactly.
Eventually, somebody did pick them up and publish
uh-huh.
some of the letters, one of mine, but it would have been saying what I thought we were going to do, which we finally did, that we would destroy them.
Stopping, we weren't fighting to stop communism?
We were ticked off, I guess. It sort of becomes a very moral thing, you know, to do these things.
Mm-hmm.
Never thinking of the disparity between our situation and the all of their economy.
Mm-hmm.
And to somebody like John Kenneth Galbraith,
uh-huh.
how you look up to those people that seem to... You say, well, they don't even have any infrastructure, you know. And in Kontum, they said they've been fighting everybody under 36 that have seen only war. They hadn't had a chance to rebuild from World War II,
mm-hmm.
which got to me, too, as a veteran, coming back and we rebuild and
mm-hmm.
make the country up. And here these people never had a chance. And I'm living in this town that just like my old hometown,
mm-hmm.
and I'm feeling a part of the place.
Mm-hmm.
What do I need a war for myself? What do they need a war? You know, it wasn't as if they were all going to get on their cyclos and paddle across the Pacific and attack California.
Yes, that was what... That's what you don't understand the communist menace. I'm being facetious here for the tape.
Well, that's the way
mm-hmm.
when you have that gap between people who've never... reached out far enough to know these people there. And whenever we give them everything at the end of a big long stick. And my purpose is going to the Navajos to learn about a culture, basically. I think I learned about it because I had a Jeep, a new Jeep there. And they had a lot of kids from high school. They used to hang around the mission. They didn't know where they wanted to go to school, what they wanted to not do. And they wanted to use my, they want, first they wanted me to take them to these places. They never said where they go. And then we'd go maybe to the squaw dance or some ceremony or maybe to help round up some cattle or something. They never asked where they're going. They said, let's just jump in and go.
But you didn't have a Jeep in Tonto.
I had one that was very much run down. And I'm very bitter about it because the guy handling that in Saigon said, he's going to send me a Jeep. And I thought, boy, I'm glad I get one. I don't want that one in that particular junk heap in that other place. Because the guy told me it's a complete junkie. Oh, they have one over there. So they shipped that one over to me. And we got into a convoy going down the road with the province chief and everybody. And it conked out. And somebody bravely stayed behind while he tried to get it fixed. I should have shoved the thing off the road and left it there. But there is, again, that's them making decisions sometimes. That, you know, I always had a new Jeep when I was... I started out with one of the World War II Jeep, but after that, I got the new...
There's one out there, I think.
There's one. I still have a 67 Jeep that I rode on the reservation. Mm-hmm. It's back in the barn there somewhere. Uh-huh. It'll be a classic one of the day.
Mm-hmm. Were there any other IVS people that you were close to while you were in Vietnam?
While I was in Vietnam, I was pretty much out there by myself. But I think when we went down for language orientation and all, and we'd have get-togethers, I think there was a certain comrade about it. And like, yeah,
do you think that other IVSers felt like you?
I think I tried to listen, and I think wherever they said something, to come to the end and say, this is something not right. You know, sometimes I'd ask somebody, you know, and everybody there knew that it wasn't. But I'd been in World War II. They were all younger than I.
Mm-hmm.
And I had some of the same tensions and the same feelings. It took me a while to figure out there was no front there.
Mm-hmm.
And that had a big meaning to it. And conquer this territory and everybody cheers and we're winning the war. Little things like that. But McNamara, I saw him on TV, he did say the alternative was genocide. And I think that's basically what it would have been because they would have kept fighting and fighting and fighting until our conscience would say, we can't do that anymore. And that's all. And then they knew that. They knew us better than we knew them. They, Ho Chi Minh and Ho Chi Minh, had been under the thumb of the white man 100 years. The Navajo know us. We may not know beans about that. They know us. And so they know how we think. That's why they're hard. If you want to get to know the Navajo, very happy to receive you, but they don't go out of their way to.
They always hoped that we would give up sooner, and they were astounded at our stubbornness given the superiority of their strategy. They figured this is the right strategy for these people, but boy, it's taking a long time. And but we weren't the French, I suppose, and we made a point of saying we weren't. I guess
it's the old phrase, you can win every battle and lose a war.
Mm-hmm.
And finally somebody else has to come in and say, well, I didn't know until I came back, actually, after that 2 years on that island. And
mm-hmm.
and this lady who was in education took me over to, was that Beverly, where the UCLA, the, where is that, where they had
UCLA is Los Angeles?
Started.
Or Berkeley. And
started Texas. Berkeley, or where the hippies were started.
San Francisco, Haight-Ashbury?
I don't think it was
San
that
Francisco
far up, was it? Was it there?
Yeah.
It's from San Diego.
Uh-huh.
Maybe she was San Francisco.
Uh-huh.
But she is on my side. Because I have said, I will not say one word. And you hear that a lot about veterans.
Mm-hmm.
Because Americans don't know what a village is.
Mm-hmm.
You can't talk about a village.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no use talking.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Buck wrote a lot of books about things. And they had a lot of them over there with IBS. And I enjoyed it. I had read some of her work before, and I
mm-hmm.
enjoyed it. And you get a little bit of a little bit of something. I think the thing that finally, my mind went back and forth between will they win or will they not? I mean, we shouldn't lose.
Mm-hmm.
But this and that went back and forth. And finally, I was in Bamatuit. And there's a little refugee camp, people from the north down,
mm-hmm.
down the hill, down at the bottom of the hill. I saw this old woman coming up. And she had this bamboo pole across her and these real heavy baskets. She was plodding her way up. And here were these young men out there. They didn't run over. And you know, zoom, you want to zap them for not helping.
Mm-hmm.
And then I catch myself. I had trained myself or had enough of it happen like that in the on the reservation, though.
Mm-hmm.
You don't just really
rush
really
in.
condemn everybody.
Right.
And I said, if they expect you to be able to do this, these must be one hell of a tough people. And she just went on up there, that little old lady, and I said, that's when we're going to lose. We can't win it.
Vietnamese that we were fighting against, but there were Vietnamese we were fighting with.
They,
both tough?
They, I don't know, I've heard one of the interpreters there, IBS interpreters, fighting against the North. They're bad if an American killed a Vietnamese. And I think all these cultural things, that's what got to me. 4,000 years of history, that is deep. We can't just go over there and bowl in a china shop. We have to feel that, just like the Indian people going back and seeing their 15 years ago, the Anasazi, the ruins of the Pueblos, there's a certain connection there, especially when the land is the same today as it was then. It hasn't been developed. In a sense, it just sort of happens that a certain thing becomes off, you know, before you can really make sense of things.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it is. You're battling yourself. That says, you know, I did love the Vietnamese people. They were all smiling and pleasant. Really enjoyed being with them.
Mm-hmm.
They're always, always pleasant, always smiling. So when we went back, you know, Reagan was always afraid, you know, how they'd hate us and all this and
mm-hmm.
everything. So when Don's group and I went back there, why, they all come welcoming us, especially these kids from the countryside.
Mm-hmm.
Healthy faces, and up the bus smiling, laughing. But us, we'd have taught them, you don't go near those people. They don't. They just let the kids go and smile and happy. That's why people go there. They don't. They wonder why they're still smiling. That's a long history.
You know, people wonder, why don't the Vietnamese hate us? And they have a hit, they have, we're not getting close to understanding how differently they look at.
I always felt, I used to listen to the broadcasts of Americans,
mm-hmm.
and no matter, and you know, very seldom that they would sound like they want to talk or be conciliatory about anything.
Mm-hmm.
And even when it sounded high and flowery, they always ended up, we will do what is necessary, and you knew just what was going to be done. I wrote a letter to the Seattle Times after Rusk died.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And he was saying how he underestimated the tenacity of the enemy, and he overestimated the patience.
Mm-hmm. American people.
American. And I said, I mentioned the fact that, you know, that it was inevitable because of the way we always ended the speeches. But I said it was bad enough that Rusk overlooked the dictum, know thine enemy, but it's far worse that he believed Americans would be patient enough to pursue such folly forever. And that's what they expected. He was trying to blame the American people for being impatient, and he didn't feel any regret that he didn't remove. They didn't know what was going
on. They published that letter?
They published that one. But I haven't read anything else except that one thing because I remembered about him. They try to duck out of things, you know.
Oh, yes.
And General Taylor did about the same thing. Mm-hmm. We didn't understand the Vietnamese. We didn't understand ourselves. And he gave a talk to our group at one time. Mm-hmm. That was towards the end of my term. I don't know. You know, they just...
You mean...
Put it all in.
But what did he... Did he... What did he say to your group?
Well, I asked him one question. Mm-hmm. I got a letter from someone back here in the States, and they said, people want to know when the war will end. Mm-hmm. And he said, does anybody know what will happen tomorrow? Sounds like a Buddhist, you know.
Yes, he'd been in Vietnam too long, perhaps, as the, what is it, the, he had gone local. Let's put the best spin on it. But, you know, I'm interested in that. That's an interesting reflection. Do you think Taylor actually had a better understanding but was just trapped into doing what?
Well, I thought he would be somebody who spoke six languages. Mm-hmm. I thought he must have some sort of cultural sensitivity. But mm-hmm. He was all army in a way. Very nice. He looked like an angel, and I think that's why they picked him, somebody like that. Maybe after Eisenhower looked the way. I don't know what they call it. Pick these innocuous-looking people, just like Westmoreland. I first saw him, I thought he was just a tall Boy Scout, ramrod straight. And he looked like a Boy Scout. And I'm sure they pick him to look that image. You know, what does he know? Let's so have that image. And General Taylor went round and round when I asked, I don't know what he was talking around when I asked him, thinking people want to know when the war will end. Finally, he stopped and he said, looked at me and said, we've got the horses. I thought later on maybe he should have wished he had elephants.
Yeah.
No, everything a contradict, but it was amusing. Everything is, some things can be so bad sometimes you laugh and... I never did find my Shangri-La. Well, we went back in a helicopter one time with a medical person, and the one who went up there on that penthouse for that party, and we saw this in those high mountains, some of the highest mountains, I guess they're 10,000 feet, and they had all the beautiful fog around them, and there'd be a village in there. You could spot through that fog. The clouds, the village. This is where I want to be. Come out here and see all these villages where nobody has been around these villages. And I suppose they've been wiped out.
There's some tough economic times. They're essentially being...
Those are long-range things that, you know, if we care just for caring's sake, we wouldn't have a Cambodian situation the way we have now. Mm. But we don't have that any principles about these things. Fighting World War II over again, being very patriotic by smashing somebody because we don't like them, even though we don't get any, rack up any points, it means anything. Long term, it's pretty bad, but I don't care to think about it, and I'm glad that I took my son out and took myself at the same time. The war, you know, the war can be very depressing too. And the pleasantness of it, and the smiliness of it. It was very valuable to me. I never forget them.
Your IBS experiences, your IBS experience was very...
That's what I liked. I liked the idea they gave you freedom. I like the idea they had English teachers. They don't now. But a teacher can get closer to people, through the children, and get those ripples of feeling and sentiment on a daily basis. And just agriculture, or just any kind of particular task, you kind of narrow things down. But as a teacher on the reservation, you come in contact with kids, you come in contact with the parents that way too. It's more getting closer to the family. So I regretted that they didn't have more English teachers there. At times I thought I might want to go back, but they didn't do at the time.
And now it's, well, Saigon is becoming pretty much like it was in 1960. I sure appreciate you seeing me on a short notice, and it's been delightful talking to you. Thank you very much.
I don't know where he is.
We were just talking about Don Luce, and Walter remarked that he was the kind of person who represented Vietnam, but they didn't pay too much attention to him.
Yeah. In a sense, he was younger, and that was a disadvantage. I seen him cool his heel outside of the USAM office for 2 or 3 hours, when they know very well that somebody's waiting there, but he didn't have the authority of being older. And perhaps if the leader of the IBS at that time in Washington had been both of them over there, somebody might have spoken out for that side, but they wouldn't listen.
And, okay, well, here, let me just finish.